Welcome today to our interview series with the world's top outstanding professionals and innovators. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Eric Jackson, CEO and co-founder, CapLinked. Eric is a global top executive and innovating entrepreneur. Eric, you know, you just have an amazing background with so much success, so thank you so much for coming in today and sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thank you, Stephen. It's really an honor to be here, and the pleasure's all mine.
Now, Eric, again, as I mentioned, you have an amazing history. So can you profile your prior top roles and then useful lessons from those roles?
Well, sure. I'd be happy to speak to that. You know, I actually started out my career not as an entrepreneur at all. Like so many entrepreneurs, I think it's something you learn about yourself as you are out there and actually doing things in the world. And, you know, I started doing financial consulting, but it was about a year and a half after I had taken that position that I was recruited over to PayPal. And, you know, that sounds really exciting now, but at the time, this was 1999, nobody had heard of PayPal. The website had just launched. And, I was fortunate. I'd known Peter Thiel, the founder and CEO of PayPal, from before. So to have him bring me in to that position and work there over the next 4 years as that company launched, was really, remarkable. I ended up running the marketing team, and there's really so many lessons that could be shared about that time there at PayPal. But I think the most important one was that innovation is critical for a company to succeed. And PayPal had to change so many times. And in fact, in the first 3 months alone that I was there, we changed both our business model as well as the platform we were on. We were focused originally on person-to-person payments, and we shifted toward auction payments, and we veered away from handheld devices like Palm Pilots to focus on our online application. So I think that nimbleness, that speed, and that ability to adjust was really a key takeaway amongst many others that I wrote about in my book, The PayPal Wars, that could be concluded from being there. So those lessons were not lost on me. After my time at PayPal, I started a media company called World Ahead Media, and I raised some money, had a co-founder from PayPal that joined me there, and we later sold that company off. And, you know, I think the lessons of speed, of flexibility, and being responsive to data and trying to see the world as it is, not as you hope it would be, were lessons that followed me from PayPal through World Ahead up through my venture today, CapLinked. And that's something that I've never forgotten and always try to apply, you know, even here at CapLinked as we're building financial software for our clients that are managing online financial transactions like mergers or capital raises. That's a lesson that's been useful and has really been applicable across the course of my career.
You know, it's really fascinating. I guess sort of being agile and being able to pivot is a hallmark of your career. And so how did your past experiences lead then to the founding of CapLinked?
Well, that's a good question, Stephen, and really they directly contributed to it. So as I mentioned, after leaving PayPal, I started a company called World Ahead Media, and we raised money for that, and we eventually sold the company in 2008. And that process of selling a company was extremely cumbersome. I mean, it's hard enough to just negotiate a deal and to negotiate all the terms, but the due diligence, the information that had to go back and forth, the process took several months. And, you know, for a small size company, I might add, it was extremely onerous. And so, you know, at the end of that process, I really thought like there should be a better way. All the emails, the spreadsheets were keeping track of lists, frequent communication and miscommunication about data that had been shared, FedExing around CD-ROMs full of data and also hard copies of information. The due diligence was quite extensive and quite cumbersome. And so, you know, that lesson stuck with me. And when I met with my current co-founder, Christopher Gray, from CapLinked, he'd also been in private equity for many years, and we were really comparing notes, and we felt there should be a better way to manage transactions. There should be a simple way that's affordable, that multiple parties could use online technology in order to exchange information, ask questions back and forth, and make that entire process of doing a business transaction a lot easier.
Ah, I can see then how all of your experiences have really led to why you formed CapLinked. So just going on further then, can you overview the business of revenue model for CapLinked and why people should get involved?
Sure. CapLinked, we offer our customers a simple subscription. And what we're providing is just a simple service where you can use the cloud to carefully manage the exchange of sensitive information and enhance the workflow that goes into managing a business transaction. So for example, if you're maybe syndicating an asset like commercial real estate, or you're doing a financing for your company where you're raising some money, you'd have sensitive information online. You wouldn't want just anyone to access it. You surely wouldn't want to use a service like Dropbox, which is great for consumer tools, but it just doesn't have security tools built in. You want something that's safe, that has permissions attached to it, that's in the cloud. You can track the progress they're making, see who's really engaged and who's doing what. And then also, you know, have that data preserved in case there's ever a question or a dispute that comes up later. So that's what CapLink does. It provides the benefit of making that entire process, that workflow, go a lot faster when you've got multiple parties working together on a business transaction or some sort of a sensitive project. And for our clients, we provide just simple upfront pricing. It's a subscription service, software as a service. So you can get a subscription, know exactly how much it's going to cost. Unlike some of the older data room companies that have been out there for a while that have, you know, really kind of old technology and are frankly hard to use, aren't compatible with an iPad, those companies will often charge you by the page. CapLink just gives you upfront pricing. It's flat, so you'll know exactly what the cost is going to be, and there are no surprises. So it's a really simple simple model, very economical, very easy to use, and that ability for multiple parties to come together and use a simple technology for a complicated process like this is a big part of the value proposition why people use CapLink for managing transactions.
I know that you're constantly monitoring this an amazing business that you have. Do you have any idea how many countries are involved, or people from different countries are involved in your platform? And I guess the second part of that is sort of the number of transactions or the number of people who've registered.
Sure. Yeah. In terms of the number of countries, last year we had users from over 40 countries across the world that were using CapLink, and there are no limits on which countries are allowed. So we do allow customers from any country. So it really is a global platform where we're seeing companies on every continent that are using it to manage transactions securely. And in terms of number of users and number of businesses and deals, we don't publicly release that information, other than to say that transactions that are in the millions and millions and millions of dollars are being done on CapLink on a daily basis. And we've had really all of the major investment banks, all of the major law firms have been on the platform and used it with their clients for transactions. So in addition to having a number of, you know, very well-known clients, all the major banks and law firms across the globe have used it as well. So we're really excited about just the extent to which CapLink has become a useful business tool, but also, frankly, just pleased that it's so simple, so intuitive that, you know, it just really makes for a good user experience no matter what country you're from.
You know, that's interesting. So you got this really engaging, simple-use platform. And, you know, you have some U.S. policy, for example, the Jobs Act, the Jumpstarter Business Startups Act. And I guess that gets into crowdfunding. So what are your views on crowdfunding?
That's a great question, Stephen. And you know, I think crowdfunding is a very interesting new phenomenon. I think that the Jobs Act is a good step in the right direction for U.S. policy. And the Jobs Act did multiple things. For one thing, it made crowdfunding legal. The U.S. is highly regulated financially, as I'm sure all of your listeners and readers would know, that the U.S. has historically, ever since the Great Depression, been very, very regulatory-minded towards finance, and, you know, for good and for bad. And so the Jobs Act allowed crowdfunding, which is to say, investments from a wide array of individuals, not just rich and sophisticated investors, but ordinary investors as well, to become legal, because those previously were outlawed in the U.S. So it was always said that a middle-class person couldn't invest in the next Facebook because the laws prevented them from doing so. Now, that became legal. And the other thing the Jobs Act did, which was to allow for general solicitation, that is to say, sort of public advertising of investment opportunities that weren't related to crowdfunding. And that's also an interesting move. Previously, if you were a company like a startup, for example, you weren't allowed to go around and publicly tell people, you know, on Twitter or Facebook, much less at a big event if you're up on stage, that you're raising money. It was considered a general solicitation, and that was illegal. So that's become legal now as well. Now, as far as crowdfunding, I think there's a lot of potential there, but I think we'll just have to wait and see. I tend to be cautious with this because I think it's certainly going to be interesting, but we've just had sort of the regulatory rules released. After the law gets changed, the regulators still have to provide rules. So those have just been put out. There are a number of websites that are building crowdfunding tools. So all these things will come to market, and we're going to have to see, what the reaction is and what types of companies will seek it out. If you have really innovative companies like Facebook or Twitter, companies that are, have huge growth potential, if they start leveraging this type of technology, then that's going to be fantastic. But if they choose not to, if they're more apt to stick with the traditional financing, that is to say to go to angel investors and venture capitalists, then that means that you might not have as interesting companies that are going to be seeking out crowdfunding, so the investment opportunities might not be quite as good. Only time will tell.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. I guess it's still early stage. I just got back from the international CES in Vegas last week, and they had this startup forum. I think there was about 500 to 600 startups there, but there was an entire section that was totally crowdfunded, and it was interesting talking to each one of them and their take on it. But like you said, it's very early stage. So I'm not sure if you can answer this question, but from the long-term perspective, do you believe the crowdfunding will supplement then traditional funding approaches or be totally disruptive and significantly replace traditional funding approaches?
That's a great question. I think I'll take a more cautious outlook at this point because we just don't know. There's certainly a lot of enthusiasm and some might even say hype around crowdfunding. And I think that any time there's that much excitement or euphoria, it's always good to be a little bit cautious. So I think it'll clearly have a role in supplementing financing, but I do think it could be interesting to see if it becomes a two-track system. So certain types of companies that are not as good for angel investing and traditional VC investing might be more apt to select into crowdfunding, and therefore crowdfunding might provide sort of an alternative financing route that lives alongside more traditional growth financing. So I think that would be my sort of outlook. I don't know that it necessarily is so disruptive that old forms of financing go away, but I think that it could supplement them well. I'm also curious to see if crowdfunding ever becomes a tool that can be helpful for other types of businesses that aren't necessarily high growth. Here in the U.S., we have the constant problem of funding small to medium-sized businesses that might otherwise be good companies, but are certainly not high growth like a technology startup, for example. So traditionally, those have been financed in some form by bank loans. And so, if there are alternative financing vehicles that come out of crowdfunding over the years to come, that will certainly be interesting to see if that opens up small to medium-sized business growth. My company, CapLink, has not been financed by crowdfunding. It's public record. We put out media announcements about our investors, and our investors include people such as Peter Thiel, who is the co-founder at PayPal, Founders Fund, 500 Startups, as well as a number of other well-known angel investors, VCs, and so forth. And I wouldn't want to have pursued a path that prevented me from raising money from those people because they're valuable. They provide input. They provide networking and connections. They make introductions for me. They also provide a stamp of authenticity. It's good for doing business when I can point to the people that have helped finance CapLink. So with that kind of a logic in mind, and I don't think my thinking is that unique, I believe other startup founders will consider the different options that are in front of them. And it's awfully hard to say no to smart money when you have that opportunity to raise it from, well-known angels and well-known venture capitalists.
Well, I guess then, you have this series of well-known investors in CapLink, and they really do provide third-party validation of CapLink, and I guess that would also attract business to CapLink because of that third-party validation. And in addition, your, Truness background of success. So, let's talk further about CapLink. How does fundraising and social networking interlink, and to what degree with CapLink?
Well, that's a good question. Fundraising is an activity that often is done on CapLink. Now, not so frequently for startups and early stage companies, more frequently for companies that are looking to expand or to grow. And sometimes actually for private equity funds as well. We found that private equity funds, hedge funds, and other types of funds that are raising money from their investors that are frequently working with accredited investors or family offices will frequently need a tool like CapLink to help them be able to raise capital. So private equity fundraising has been a great area for CapLink and an area where our software is very helpful for coordinating a sales and marketing team that's working on a medium to large size fund. But certainly for companies as well, companies that the CFO's office might be managing a line of credit or some other type of financing event where you have to invite external investors to review sensitive materials. So CapLink is fantastic for those type of activities. And earlier stage companies certainly could use it, but typically for a very young company, you don't have a lot of due diligence materials. And if it's early stage and very speculative, it might just even be a simple PowerPoint presentation that describes the business and perhaps an Excel file with some speculative financial projections. So that use case is not as common for CapLink as more mature companies and private equity funds when it comes to fundraising. Now, as far as social networking and that ability to sort of broadcast publicly, fundraising or transactional activities, that's not something that's really integrated with CapLink because we find that our customers want privacy. And they're typically at a point where they've found people that they want to do business with. They've found potential buyers if it's a merger or acquisition scenario, or they're talking with prospective investors, perhaps if they're syndicating an asset for sale like commercial real estate. So typically what they want is privacy, and they want the ability for prospective buyers or investors to come, review materials, ask them questions, communicate back and forth, conclude the due diligence process, and really safely share that data but track where it goes. So to that extent, privacy and security are top concerns. And the networking, per se, that's going on CapLink is not so much public. It is really private exchanging of information.
So then what do you see as your critical success factors?
Well, the critical success factors for CapLink are having a great product. And what having a great product means, first and foremost, I believe, is a wonderful user experience, a user interface that's really easy to navigate, very intuitive, very visual, and it works just as it should for both sides. And by that, I mean for the company that's uploading data or their advisors, if they're working bankers or lawyers, to make that simple to get sometimes hundreds or even thousands of documents up into the cloud, and then to assign permission levels to all of those documents, and to be able to manage it and track it. And then likewise for the other side, if they're a buyer, if they're an investor, whoever the case, whatever the case would be, that they're able to get an invitation, come in, log in quickly and easily into the website, and be able to access just the information that's right for them. There's a lot of moving parts when you think about that. And to make this simple and easy to use is quite critical. Many of the old technology that's out there for enterprises and for businesses, for example, virtual data rooms, and those are typically technology that's been around since the late 90s. So we're really talking 15, 16 years old at this point. It's hard to use. It's often programmed in Microsoft's .NET language, and that requires a lot of Java and a lot of Flash. Frequently, that'll cause a browser to break or crash. You have to upload new plugins into the browser. It doesn't work on an iPad. So having a great user experience, as CapLink does, means not using Java and Flash, having complete browser compatibility, being able to use it on an iPad, and having it just work. Not having to think that hard about the software, but having it just work. That's critical success factor, because people that are doing business today and are doing deals, they have to travel a lot, they're in meetings, they've got to be able to use their iPad or their tablet if they're on the go. They don't want to have to worry about the other side that they're trying to do the deal with having difficulty logging in or difficulty viewing a file. So taking all that guesswork out of it and making it just really simple, but not sacrificing security, not sacrificing on price, those are all key things that have made CapLink successful.
That's really fascinating. So what do you see as your vision for CapLink in the next 5 years?
CapLink's potential to to disrupt the way companies manage their deals and other sensitive projects is quite tremendous. That ability to streamline the workflow of these complicated tasks and making it simple to deal with large amounts of sensitive data where you do have security concerns, you do have to leverage the cloud in a productive way. You can't do all this business behind your firewall if you're an enterprise. CapLink is making that simple and giving businesses a powerful extension into the cloud that can allow other companies to come do business with them, collaborate with them, access sensitive documents, have all that tracked securely. That's very powerful and very disruptive. So in that sense, CapLink has the potential to be very disruptive for the way companies share sensitive data and the way they can streamline processes for working on a deal and working on a sensitive project, whether it's consulting project or litigation or whatever the situation might be. So I think that ability to streamline and simplify all that is quite key to what CapLink can do and how it can be disruptive. And frankly, the ease of use of the service to invite people into a project and then having an account where you can manage projects of your own from it makes CapLink a very viral and intuitive process. So we've seen this over time as companies get invited to work with another company on CapLink. They'll like it, they'll enjoy the experience, and they'll contact us about setting up projects of their own. So we really do see that disruption that comes from the ease of use and the security that CapLink provides as something that has really taken off in the last year, and we anticipate continuing to grow over the next 5 years.
Now, earlier at the very beginning of this interview, you talked about PayPal, and really it's sort of your historic contribution to this amazing group. Can you comment more on the PayPal Mafia?
Certainly, Stephen. The PayPal Mafia is it's a fantastic nickname that's been given to so many of the PayPal alumni. And really, there's no wonder when you think about the people that were involved with PayPal and what they've gone on to do since then. It's really quite remarkable. And a brief list, and I apologize for anyone I'm excluding here because there just are so many, but you're talking about people such as Peter Thiel, who was the co-founder and CEO of PayPal, and has gone on to invest in many well-known companies, Facebook being the most famous of them. You have Max Levchin, who is the chief technology officer. He is now the chairman of Yelp, and has also started Slide, which was sold to Google. Elon Musk, of course, who's very famous, deservedly so, who is the founder and CEO of both SpaceX and Tesla, and is a main investor in SolarCity. So he's invested in some very risky technologies and seems to be having success with all of them. David Sachs, who was my boss for much of my time there at PayPal, and he started Yammer, and which was subsequently bought by Microsoft. Reid Hoffman, who started LinkedIn, Chad Hurley, and Steve Chin, who started YouTube. The list just goes on and on and on. Jeremy Stoppelman, who's the CEO of Yelp. And again, I'm failing to mention, you know, many others who have also been very, very successful in their own right. So it's just a remarkable collection of talent that we've seen come out of PayPal. And I think that's the reason it's been given this PayPal Mafia term, because people from PayPal that are alumni, they tend to know each other, trust each other. So they'll give each other advice, sometimes make investments in each other's companies. And so that's how the term got coined. And I'll say this, it really is, it was wonderful to have had a chance to work alongside these people, to have a number of them, including Peter Thiel and David Sachs, Dave McClure from 500 Startups, and Joe Lonsdale, who's a co-founder of Palantir, to have all of them invest in my company, CapLink. You know, it's certainly been an honor to have that support and also to have their ongoing advice in terms of what we do. So that's really what the PayPal Mafia is. There's nothing secretive about it or sinister about it. It's just you had a lot of really bright, motivated people that came out of PayPal and then left PayPal after eBay bought the company. And they've just gone on to start other businesses and work with each other on advice and investment for those businesses.
Well, you know, you're one of them, so you're part of this brain trust that continues to echo around the world in terms of your historical contributions. You're also a noted writer, best-selling writer and author. So how do you believe that your skills as an author contribute to your success as an entrepreneur and leader?
Well, Stephen, I would actually turn it around a little bit. And I think that my experiences as an entrepreneur and a leader, and somebody who was fortunate enough to be part of that PayPal team were what helped me, as an author. And my book, The PayPal Wars, which, came out actually 10 years ago, was born of that desire really to chronicle everything that happened at PayPal during that period from 1999 through 2003 as PayPal launched and grew faster than anything that had really been seen, you know, that was of a comparable nature, was extremely viral, and grew and went from being a company that was losing $10 million a month at its worst points in 2000, where we were had a broken business model, there were foreign fraud rings, were taking money out of PayPal. There was all sorts of problems to actually becoming profitable, having an initial public offering and then eventually being bought by eBay. So that story and those experiences were so unique and just so noteworthy that I thought that they had to be captured and turned into something that could be shared with other people. And frankly, even though when I wrote the book, I had no idea of all the future success that the PayPal team would go on to have, the PayPal Mafia. But I did know that there were a lot of remarkable people that I worked with. So I wanted to make sure that some of their stories were recorded in the PayPal Wars as well. And all that led to what I think was a really engaging story, or hopefully it was an engaging story, and intentionally told from the vantage point of being there, not boiled down to abstraction and high level, but really in the trenches, day by day, recounting what was going on in the midst of creating a company like that. And I think that firsthand account, that very deliberate attempt to pull the reader back into that point in time where they're right in the middle of what's going on in PayPal, I think is what helped make that a useful story for entrepreneurs and leaders today that really want to understand what it's like to start a business, what it's like to start a technology company, and the challenges that that you face along the way creating a company like that.
You're a very well-known leader, you know, because of your success history, because of all the things that you've done together with CapLink. Do you see another book in the offerings maybe, you know, 5 years' time or 3 years' time, something like that?
Oh, no, I can't commit to that right now. I laugh because I've been asked that question before, and I love reading, and I try to read a book every week or two, but it takes a lot of time and energy to write a good book. And so I'd love to write a book again in the future. What that will be about, I have no idea. And when that would happen, I have no idea. I just know that for now, I'm too busy just leading CapLink and trying to continue to grow CapLink and make it a better product to worry about writing a book. But I will say this, that if you're going to write a book about something, you need to really make sure you care about it and you're passionate about it.
You are in the media, though, and sometimes you make comments about the political environment. Now, is that something you want to make further comment on, or do you want to leave that alone?
Oh, my goodness. There's so much that one could comment on. I think I would say this, I hope that the United States gets its fiscal house in order sometime soon, because I think for the long-run stability and health of the entire planet, that's a very important thing. And I think making sure that we stop our runaway spending and try to keep taxes and regulations as low as possible are going to be very critical things for the United States to remain a financial superpower and a good, you know, a good trading partner and business partner for China and Europe, the rest of Asia, South America, as that continent increasingly modernizes its economies. So I do think that it's important not just for those of us that are here in the U.S., but for the entire globe, for the U.S. to really get its house in order. So I will certainly make that comment about politics. But in addition to getting the deficit spending down, to really keep an eye on taxes and regulation, because at the extreme they do stifle innovation. And if we're not careful, it's always easy to spend another dollar that you don't have. And it's not, and when you don't necessarily feel the effects of that immediately, then it gives you the temptation to keep spending. So hopefully people here in the U.S. can be forward looking and think about that and realize that it's important to stay away from that kind of spend first mentality. Otherwise we're going to have a lot of problems and instability down the road.
Now, Eric, one of the things we hear a lot about is big data, you know, and maybe that term is now sort of confused, but you know, do you see the value of big data and financial services and, you know, in the marketplace that you're in and how it can be used?
Big data is, I think, going to be a very popular term that is much discussed in 2014. And I think it's something that people are really starting to talk about a lot because it's only recent that we've been able to leverage big data and begin to understand what that means. And there's so many general terms for it. I think I would say that big data, when it comes to financial services, relates to several key aspects, particularly of what the type of area that CapLink did. First, I think it relates to the knowledge that has to be shared when due diligence is being performed. And that is the tricky part. As there's more and more data available, there's going to be increasing demands to share that data during due diligence. So if one company is acquiring another in a merger or acquisition scenario, if a financial investment is being made into a company, if an asset's being sold, the due diligence requests are just going to be more onerous, more strenuous, because there's additional data that can be provided. So being prepared to share that data and having a secure mechanism to share that data is going to become quite important. And the other aspect, though, that particularly regarding financial services and transactions that we're talking about here that relates to big data, is having analytics to understand what's going on inside of a deal, to really understand who's active, who's coming through, who's looking at data and performing due diligence. If it's your side and you're in charge of accumulating all that data to make sure that all the different people that are involved are on task and on top of it. So having embedded analytics in an application like CapLink that help you monitor all that and manage that is quite critical. So I think that's a couple of ways that big data factors into financial services and the area that CapLink is in. And I think that volume of data is just going to continue to grow at an exponential rate. So this is a term that's become quite popular, but don't expect it to go away anytime soon. It's going to play an increasingly important role in the process of due diligence and closing financial transactions.
Well, Eric, I mean, for the audience, it's a real treat because you do have that global insight because of all the things that you do in your background. Now, the next three questions have to do with, you know, the financial markets maybe globally and sort of the impact that's going to have. And the first part is you talked about, let's say, over 40 countries being involved in a CapLink in some way. So what is your global strategy for CapLink?
Well, the global strategy for CapLink is to make CapLink available around the globe and to make it easily accessible for companies regardless of their geographic location. And in truth, CapLink is still, well, it's obviously based in the U.S. We're based here in California. And our sales team is located currently in the U.S., but we actually do have a global relationship. As I mentioned earlier, we're already being used in 40 countries worldwide. And I think that just speaks to the power of the Internet and that power to make a good product that can be accessed anywhere and be used by anyone in a very intuitive way. So continuing to ramp up our global footprint, to expand on that list of 40 countries, and to really broaden our international presence are all key things that we're focused on for the year ahead. Also making CapLink available in local or regional data centers to really have fast processing of information is something that we can also provide to our global clients. So that sense of gradual global expansion and really just continuing to service our clients well with a wonderful product, that's something that I think has universal appeal and really doesn't matter what country you're in. If you've got the most innovative, easy-to-use product, customers will find you. And that's what we've tried to do, and that's why we've been very product-centric as we've launched CapLink and had an eye toward expansion in global markets.
So tying into this sort of question on global strategy and global markets, you know, we have the U.S. economy, let's say it's 14-plus trillion GDP, that is nominal GDP, and you have the Chinese economy, I guess about 7-plus trillion nominal GDP, and yet by 2015, 2016, let's say the Chinese will match the U.S. economy and PPP GDP and nominal GDP perhaps overtake the U.S. Sometime before 2025. And then we also have this other fact that in August of 2013, the Chinese central government launched a program for financial market openness. So because of who you are and the market you're in, you're leading this great platform, CapLink, and your history, can you provide your forecast of where you feel this will lead and its implications?
I think the Chinese government has been very intelligent in the majority of decisions it's made for many years now. And I think that China's increasing openness and embrace of market reforms have done nothing but to improve the economy and strengthen Chinese companies. And I think, frankly, provide a good model for much of the rest of the world that centralized decision-making, excessive amounts of government spending, and really a reliance on central planning is outdated and I think should be wholesalely rejected and moved away from. And I think that the continued effort on the part of the Chinese government to encourage openness is a very positive sign that will surely benefit the economy and increase China's role in the international marketplace. So that being said, and in terms of forecasts about where this will lead, it's always hard to predict the exact dollar amounts and dates and so forth. And I think though the basic numbers that you shared about GDP growth, which, you know, have been much discussed in the last couple of years, both based on purchasing power as well as nominal GDP growth, I think are really eye-opening. The issue of the Chinese market growing larger than the U.S. market is, you know, I think a bit of the wrong topic to talk about, though. I think the bigger concern, I would say, that people should be concerned about, particularly here in the U.S., is more this perpetual slowdown in GDP growth that the United States is having. If China is growing, then that's great. And economic growth is something that should be wished for every country. And I think that the success of embracing market reforms and embracing openness that the Chinese government has undertaken over the last 30 plus years is to be emulated by other countries that have been too centralized. But I think the U.S. needs to focus more on its own house, and in fact, perhaps learn a few lessons that are readily observable, that centralization and excessive spending don't work, but that's not a way to encourage growth, that you actually have to promote investments, risk-taking, and entrepreneurship as means of encouraging economic growth, rather than thinking that any solution is going to come out of Washington, D.C.
And that's kind of fascinating. You know, you talk about the U.S. standing and rankings, or I guess I'm bringing up this idea of rankings, and your comments are sort of catalysts for this. You know, the U.S. has not been number one in rankings in innovation or in other areas, in education and so on. And, you know, China graduates, I think, close to now 1 million engineers a year. The U.S. graduates something like 60 to 70,000, which is the same number as South Korea, but South Korea has a population of 50, 60 million. You know, what are the implications of that if in the West we don't wake up to the fact that innovation, education, risk-taking, and sponsoring entrepreneurship is a key vital area to stay ahead of the game? Do you have any comments on that?
Oh, I certainly do. It's a great concern, and I think that there's certainly many things here in the West that we can worry about. And in the U.S. in particular, the lack of engineers, as you mentioned, is a real problem. The lack of risk taking, the decrease in risk taking, those are all major issues. I think that broadly speaking, in the U.S., we need to return to a more of a risk taking and self-reliance posture in the way we think about these things. And I think there are several trends that are long-term very disconcerting. First and foremost, I think the biggest issue, which no one is talking about as an economic issue here in the U.S., is the propensity for out-of-wedlock births. And I mention that not from a moral or religious perspective. Everyone certainly has feelings about that. But actually, from an economic perspective, single mothers are much more likely to be below the poverty line. And that trend toward not having families and children that have both a mother and a father that are there in the household has led to a lot more economic instability in the U.S. People talk about the economy. People talk about how somehow greedy capitalists are to blame for income disparity. And the truth is that's not correct. It much more comes down to demographic behavior. And this propensity for single-family households leads to a lot of these economic outcomes. And the economic outcomes also in turn impact education and the trajectory of the lives of these children and where they will go and what potential opportunities there are for them in the economy. So these things are all interrelated. And I think that societal issue is one that is quite huge. Likewise, I point to the societal issue of spending money and not saving money, having very low savings rate. The savings rate rebounded a little bit after the financial crisis in 2008, but it's come back down, in the ensuing years. So in essence, we see these trends, in the culture, in society, that are promoting less stability and worsening the future prospects of the country. I don't think there's necessarily a magic way that government can solve those problems, but certainly it's probably exacerbating them in a few areas by creating disincentives that it's unaware that it's doing. But I think in addition to that, the point about having talented people and also having a risk-taking entrepreneurial environment are a couple of points that are very important. In the years to come for the U.S. to remain competitive, these societal issues that I mentioned a second ago, they won't be resolved overnight. And obviously they are important to undertake. But I think from a policy perspective, the U.S. needs to look at how it can become very capital friendly. We need to attract the capital, the investment capital of the world. And we've been fortunate to do so, although a lot of that's going into government debt right now. And I'd argue that's not a very good place for capital to be, certainly a low productivity rate that's associated with that low return on investment. But I think getting the U.S. to the point where it is a place where money flows into, because capital gains rates are low, taxation's favorable, regulation is low, risk-taking is rewarded, I think those are good policy initiatives, coupled with immigration policy that encourages educated and trained risk-taking people that want to come here to do so. So let us import engineers from the rest of the world if we don't have enough in the short term. That's how to be competitive. Let's get the world's capital. Let's invite the smartest, hardest working people in the world to come here and join our free market economy. That's going to be something that benefits everyone. That has to be done at a policy level. And hopefully that can be supplemented by some societal changes as well that encourage nuclear families, that encourage saving and really help people to think about, you know, preparing for the future as opposed to thinking that somehow the government or some other entity is going to be what takes care of them.
You know, I find that fascinating in terms of your recommendations of policy changes, and I see some of that echoed with Rob Atkinson with the IT Innovation Foundation, and they produced a report called the Global Innovation Policy Index, and where, you know, Western countries, particularly the U.S., is lagging, and why they're lagging, and you know, that research supports what you're saying.
But I think Lincoln really understood the need for modernization in the economy. Back in those days, it was promoting the railroad and to build a truly national economy because everything was local and regional before the network of the railroad opened up the interior parts of the country and connected them with the East Coast. So I think that sense of modernization and promoting technology is important. But Lincoln also believed in personal responsibility and certainly not an excessive nanny state. There was an instance, I was recently reading a book about him, where he declined to lend money to his brother-in-law, who'd written to him, and in his letter explaining his decision said that he wishes him the best. He'd be happy to under different circumstances, but he thought that idleness and drinking were this man's problems, not bad luck. And so Lincoln certainly believed in personal responsibility. So I think recapturing that sense of promoting technology coupled with personal responsibility as a means of improving your situation and celebrating success were hallmarks of Lincoln's vision. And I think that's a healthy way for America to look at the future, to look back at the past and look at that kind of perspective that Abraham Lincoln had. And I think it's applicable today as it was back in the 1850s and 1860s when he was espousing it.
Now, Eric, we know that you're a renowned executive thought leader, thinker, writer, and entrepreneur. So from that extensive experience you've done speaking, traveling, and work, do you have any stories you can share? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Well, I certainly could share a couple of stories from PayPal that come to mind, and I included these in my book, The PayPal Wars, because I think they were interesting and they're good to share. The first one is just a little snippet that I think teaches people about entrepreneurship that maybe haven't experienced that before. When I joined PayPal, I was working in financial consulting before then, and when I was invited by Peter Thiel to come join PayPal and made the leap, I showed up at the office the first day, and Peter, who was CEO, he was very busy. I mean, I understand that completely now as the CEO of Kaplan, that there's always a million things you have to take care of, so you're focused on the next problem. Peter had forgotten to tell anyone else that he'd hired me, and he wasn't there. And so when I showed up, no one knew that I'd been hired. I just quit my other job and showed up, and people were very confused. And so I was worried that something had gone wrong. And then when that got cleared up on my first day, I had to put my own desk together. They weren't ready for me. So I started on a Friday. I remember that. I had to borrow somebody else's desk who was out of the office that day, and I came back in on Saturday to assemble this desk that they bought from IKEA for me. So I put my own desk together, and it really was a great way to actually start that journey of entrepreneurship, because it gives you the sense of humility, of practicality, of just being able to address whatever the situation is in front of you, and not to think that somehow you're above whatever, you know, that problem is, that you shouldn't have to be dealing with it. So that was a great baptism by fire, and a really funny story now with hindsight of joining PayPal. And then one other story that comes to mind that I think is a good one to share, and just very amusing, is from PayPal's early days. It has to do with some of the crime rings, the organized crime rings that were initially trying to exploit weaknesses on PayPal. And it's not that PayPal was ever hacked or information was stolen. No, no, that wasn't it. What some of these foreign crime rings would do, they would get stolen credit card numbers off the black market and then bring them to PayPal. They'd use technology to set up a PayPal account and make payments to their other accounts so they could wire that out. So it's a good way to launder money off of a stolen credit card that was taken somewhere else. Well, one of these fraudsters had been communicating with our fraud investigation team and been really taunting them over time. And they ended up, as they got more and more information about this guy, flattering him, and they ultimately invited him to the U.S. and said, you're so smart, we want to hire you. And then when he showed up at San Francisco International Airport, the federal authorities were waiting there to arrest him. So it's just a really interesting story of playing some cat and mouse, using technology ultimately to overcome fraud and to catch a criminal in the act. But that's just one of many amusing stories that I wrote about in the PayPal Wars, because, like I said, there were many, many numerous and noteworthy experiences from those days. And those are just a couple that I think capture the spirit of what that was like.
You know, those are great stories. So thank you for sharing them. You know, we're down to our last question, and I sort of turned the tables here, and it's sort of open-ended, and that is, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Oh, well, that's a tough question. You saved the hardest one for the end here. I think what I'd ask is, what does it take to start a successful company? What does it take in this day and age where technology changes so much to start a successful company? And I think my answer to that would be that it really, for one thing, you have to know yourself. It takes self-awareness and a willingness to undertake the risk and the lifestyle that goes along with that. It's not that glamorous. My story from PayPal about putting my desk together, that's intentional, because there's nothing glamorous about that. It's you've got to be willing to work really long, hard hours, sometimes doing things that are thankless, and you have to be all right with that. You have to have your ego in check, and you have to be just flexible enough to address whatever is coming up at any given point in time. So I think that's some of the advice that I would give if asked that hypothetical question. The other thing I would also tell people is, emotionally, when you're starting a business, when you're starting a technology company in particular, there's a lot of ups and downs. You have to be level-headed. Don't get too high. Don't get too low. Celebrate the victories a little bit. Learn from the defeats and the setbacks, but try to stay even. Don't think that don't be celebrating victory triumphantly one day and then despondent when you have a setback the next, because it will happen. So staying even, staying level-headed emotionally, those are important things, important lessons that that I would definitely share to anyone that's looking to be an entrepreneur.
Well, thank you for all of those insights and for sharing that last series of question and answer. And I know your schedule is demanding. I mean, you are a busy executive and, of course, one of the leading executives in the world. So thank you for coming in today and sharing your experiences with the audience.
Stephen, I really appreciate it. And I invite anyone that's interested in learning more about CapLink to go to our website, www.caplink.com. And they can also write us at sales@caplink.com if they'd like to learn more about a subscription for using our service.
Thank you again, and I want to close by saying I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Eric Jackson, CEO and co-founder CapLink, a globally top-ranking executive and innovating entrepreneur.